now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Jesus Christ, you're a man.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
In less than a month, the world may end as we know it, or so say some prognosticators who are putting together signs and coming up with the conclusion that something is going to happen on September 23rd that will change everything. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest tonight is going to help us address at least one aspect of what may be ahead on September 23rd. That is, of course, the Jewish Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. But we're also told there may be something coming from the skies, from the heavens, a major astronomical event that will fundamentally change things on planet Earth. Talking about Planet X, or in some circles referred to as Planet 7X, our guest is a gentleman who was ahead of the curve in writing about this. By day, he works as a web developer in the field of information technology. At night, working as a travel writer, focusing on exotic destinations. He's got an excellent online magazine that published some very insightful, well-researched articles on the giants who walked the Earth back in the day. And then about 5 years ago, came out with a book that is, well, again, very well-researched, heavily footnoted, and very deep, and hopefully will add some a note of encouragement to the lead-up to Yom Kippur. The book is Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, and our guest is Doug Elwell. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Derek. Great to be on again.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked, and we have talked a number of times. It's, you know, the older we get, the faster time goes, and I think scientists are going to figure that out one of these days, find some property of physics unknown heretofore that will explain that phenomenon. But we have talked in a number of locations now. I think Indiana, Illinois, of course, back in Missouri when I was doing the Daily Talk Show in Columbia, you were a guest talking about giants, and we also had you on talking about St. Patrick's Day and Ireland. So, but we did talk about Planet X, your book, when it was released about 5 years ago, but it seemed appropriate to bring you back to discuss it again because of the fear and trembling that seems to be prominent on the internet about what may be approaching in the month of September. Your book, your take on it, is different from any that I have read or heard from others. Most others, I guess Gil Broussard is similar, thinking along similar lines anyway, but what is different about your view of Planet X with the prevailing, say, Zechariah Sitchin type, you know, Planet Nibiru, or the those who are looking at this as some just agent of wanton destruction, nemesis, or something along those lines?
My view is that it's based on real science rather than speculative, you know, mythology based on Zechariah Sitchin, Sumerian texts, random stuff you read on the internet. A lot of people take stuff they read on the internet and just take it for, you know, the gospel truth. This must be true. It's on the internet. And other people agree with it, so therefore it's, you know, it's popular, so let's go with it. I first encountered Sitchin back in the late 1980s. Actually, I read his book in 1987 or 88. When I was doing research on what I refer to as the sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, described in Matthew 24:30, back in the late 1980s, I was powerfully convicted by the Holy Spirit that Jesus was going to return in my lifetime, and that I was trying to find signs of His return, something more concrete than, you know, what you're reading about in the news or here on TV or on the radio or whatever. And in my study of apocalyptic, I came across Jesus' description of His second coming in Matthew 24. And He says, immediately before the tribulation of those days, the end of the tribulation, mm-hmm. there will be a sign which appears in the heavens, which will foretell His second coming. And I was wondering, okay, what is that sign? I immediately thought, for some reason, of the Star of Bethlehem, which was a heavenly sign that preceded His first coming. I thought, well, maybe this might have something to do with it. The second coming, it was a heavenly sign. It's bright, it can be seen from a long distance away, maybe it's a star or a planet. maybe I'll do some research into this to figure out what it is. So I started looking at what the Star of Bethlehem was and the various theories and what that was. The main three theories are the supernova, comet, or conjunction of planets. And even though these had their merits, I looked at them one at a time. Supernova didn't really fit the bill because supernova don't last more than a few days and they don't move relative to the background stars, as the Star of Bethlehem was said to do. The comet is interesting, but they usually portend disasters and not good things like the birth of Christ, and they usually don't only last maybe a few days during their brightest period, then they pass on. And in order to fit the bill for the Star of Bethlehem, it would have to have lasted for weeks or months because it would take a long time for the Magi to come from Persia following this star.
So right, right.
Common, which is relatively common. They happen a couple times a century. Would not have fit the bill very well for that either. And also the conjunction of planets, the most popular one being Jupiter and Saturn. This happens once every 500 years, and even though it's interesting, it's not particularly spectacular. The planets themselves, and I wonder what happened recently, I think 10 or 15 years ago. I watched it to see, well, will there be something glorious happen, and nothing happened. They kind of passed close to each other briefly and then moved away from each other a couple days later, and there was nothing really spectacular about it. And it kind of smacked of astrology, too, which I found troublesome. So there's kind of a strain of Christian astrology circulating around this type of thing, which I find troublesome. So
like the zodiac and the gospel and the stars kind of thing?
The gospel and the stars by itself is not a problem. It's just the conjunction of planets aspect of which bothers me. It's,
oh, okay.
It seems like an intrusion of astrology. That's my opinion. But it really didn't fit the bill either because, like I said, this particular conjunction, one's likely to have once every few hundred years. They're not in any way unique. So I kept looking, thinking, you know, this is interesting, but it didn't seem to be definitive, the kind of nature of the sign. The heavenly sign that Jesus is referring to, it seems to be accompanied by massive disasters. In fact, the description of the sign, it says that it's actually accompanied by powers of the heavens being shaken and asteroids falling, stars falling from heaven and earth, which sounds like asteroids, major events which appear to be linked with it. And if when I did my research on the Matthew 24:30, it says the powers of the heavens are actually considered to be the planets. So literally, if this is going to be taken literally, the powers of the heavens being shaken literally means the planets' orbits would be altered. And in order to do this, you'd have to have a planet-sized object necessary to do that according to physics and astronomy. So I kept that in mind and thinking that this object appears to be something related to massive disaster. It's not just a sign. It may actually be a causative agent of some kind. And with that in mind, I came across a book called The 12th Planet by Zechariah Sitchin. This was near the end of my search. And I was broadening my search to include non-Christian sources. And I read this book. It was interesting. Discussed the ancient Sumerians, and I mentioned the Bible a few times. And I've been interested in ancient history and culture in relationship to the Bible because scholars will study ancient cultures of the time of the Bible to gain insights into the cultural context of the Bible. So that was a valid way of looking at it. Whereas Sitchin, I realized, had taken a lot of liberties with the text and his interpretations were questionable. I think the core concept of Planet X existing I thought was interesting. So I decided to put that to the test. I actually, his theory was, as a summary, was that the ancient Sumerians, their creation epic, the Babylonian creation epic, also known as the New Elish, which means went on high, is a description of how the earth was formed, in fact, the entire solar system, according to Sitchin's interpretation. It's basically about how the earth was formed, but he interpreted it as being the entire solar system formed, and this deity named Marduk in the Babylonian creation myth was actually a planet, which in our solar system comes and goes in elliptical orbit similar to that of a comet, which an orbit he said lasted up to 3,600 years, based on the Sumerian Shar measure, which was kind of a standard measure, which kind of an all-encompassing measurement of 3,600 years. And his theory was that this planet was actually the Planet X described and mentioned by astronomers, who astronomers are looking for and have been since the century, that the Sumerians were aware of this planet and how it came and went inside of our solar system and came close enough to Earth to cause disasters every once every 3,600 years. I looked at that and I looked at, well, that's a possibility. So I looked up the Planet X theory in mainstream scientific journals and said, does Planet X exist and could it be fulfilling the characteristics mentioned by Sitchin? And I found that there was actually a search for a planet called Planet X, and that it did have orbital characteristics similar to that described in Zechariah Sitchin in his book. And then the astronomers did believe that this planet came in and outside of our solar system once every anywhere from 800 to 22,000 years or so, depending on which astronomer was doing the study. I was studying this in the late 1980s when the Voyager probes had passed outside near the outer edge of our solar system. There was
right.
a great deal of speculation about Planet X. Because when they found Uranus and Neptune, if they flew by these planets, they found that they are in great disarray. Uranus was tilted on its side with its south pole currently pointing almost directly at the sun.
Exactly. Which is really unusual. It's the only planet in the solar system that does that.
Yes, and Neptune was similarly messed up. Its rotational and magnetic axes were actually radically off mm-hmm. center with each other. They form, ironically, kind of what looks like an X when you look at the rotational magnetic poles or axes of Neptune. They're really screwed up. And just like so, the two outer planets looks like they'd met with a disastrous conflict with something. And based on the data that the Voyager probes were sending back, they determined that it must have been a conflict with an object, a planet-sized object, 3 to 5 times the mass of Earth, passing at an oblique angle into our solar system from beneath, and moving up into our solar system and interacting with these planets, which explains why they're tilted on their sides. Because in order to be influenced by a planet coming in from beneath, the gravitational effect this planet would have on them would be to tilt them. And so the reason that they came up with this idea of Planet X coming in from beneath, because that's the only way that these planets could exhibit these characteristics, they would have to be affected by a planet coming in from beneath the plane of the ecliptic. And so I'd satisfied myself with that and a variety of other literature on the subject of Planet X. It's really been searched for since the 1860s or 1870s, but formally searched for since the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, they didn't take very long after they discovered Neptune, which was, what, I think 1846, that they realized that there was something wrong about its orbit.
Yeah, they initially thought that the Neptune's orbit was off somewhat from their initial observations. They noted that it was not quite in the place it should be based on their the ephemerides that they had calculated for its orbital path, where should it be based on its mass and relative distance from the Earth. Later on, it was determined that some observations from the 1700s had been off on Neptune, so that accounted for the anomaly, but still the idea of a Planet X persisted. Kind of laid and languished on the shelf for a while after Vlad Tombaugh discovered Pluto in the 1930s. They thought that was initially Planet X, but they determined that it was just too small to be an independent planet. When the Voyager probe was passed into the outer solar system, they noted that Pluto actually, its orbit intersects with that of Neptune, indicating mm-hmm. that it was actually apparently an escaped satellite of Neptune. And this is the main reason Neptune was downgraded to non-planet status, because they determined that it was actually a former satellite of Neptune. Whose size and mass were nearly identical to Neptune's other moon, Triton, and also its orbit intersected that of Neptune, so close that it must have been in its orbit at one time. So that plus is just really too small to have formed as a planet and not enough mass to be significant. So based on that, I actually went to Wheaton College Graduate School, got a master's in Old Testament Biblical Studies, so I could learn Hebrew, and test this theory from the biblical side. Well, does it fit? If this is true, we would have to take a second look at the creation material in the Old Testament. I matched up Sitchin's theories with other descriptions about how the Babylonian creation epic was very similar to biblical creation material in the Old Testament, mentions of God's battle of the dragon in Psalm 74, Isaiah's description of the battle of Leviathan, and also numerous references in the book of Job. So many references actually determined representing the battle between God and the dragon, that were very similar to that mentioned in the Babylonian creation epic, to the point where some scholars actually believe that the biblical creation material was basically lifted off, taken from, or even ripped off from the Babylonian creation epic. I don't believe that. I think they came from a common root tradition, which Abraham took out of him from the Ur of the Chaldees when he left just before or it was destroyed by fire from heaven. But they basically came down to, I determined from the Sumerian side, the astronomical side, and also the biblical side, that there was a powerful case they made for the idea that Planet X might actually hold a central role, not only in the creation of the Earth, but also in the nativity and also the second coming of Christ.
Okay, just to make sure people hear that, because that's one thing you need to underline, that the Planet X somehow plays a pivotal role in creation at the Nativity, in signaling to the Magi from the East, you know, here's where the Savior is being born, and then it will also reappear, you believe, as the sign of the coming of the Son of Man, which is an interesting take, because this is unique. Generally, when you hear people, especially in this alt-Christian community that we move in, whenever anyone mentions Matthew 24, it's in reference to as it was in the days of Noah, and usually interpreted to mean that the genetic manipulation that created the Nephilim, similar type of genetic manipulation, was taking place today. Maybe not necessarily to recreate the Nephilim, but we look at the transhumanist movement and transgenic experimentation that's taking place. I mean, in fact, it even came up in the discussion this past week about Planned Parenthood with the release of the most recent video, or I guess video before last, where they were talking about taking material from aborted babies and using it to create transgenic mice for experimentation purposes. This is the first time that I've ever heard, you know, as it was in the days, and perhaps Planet X played a role in the flood of Noah. And again, I'm throwing this out. You didn't suggest this in the book, but maybe that's where the reference actually leads, because as it was in the days of Lot, which is a parallel verse from the Gospel of Luke, refers to Lot, who was very famously rescued out of Sodom and Gomorrah, which was destroyed by flaming, brimstone from the heavens.
Yes. I believe whenever Planet X returns into the solar system, there's a great deal of material in its orbit, both before and after it. And as a result, Earth gets bombarded by massive amounts of meteorites and asteroids, which are just basically flying all over the inner solar system like buckshot. Ironically, these are actually fragments of the original primordial Earth that was partly destroyed and moved to another location closer to the Sun due to its original conflict with Planet X. So when you have these pieces of fire and brimstone fire, falling back down on Earth, these are actually bits and pieces of the original primordial Earth, which once orbited in the fourth position where the asteroid belt is now. And so you have bits of the Earth, old Earth, falling on the new Earth in order to punish the current Earth. Kind of ironic.
Well, let's talk about the creation aspect, because you open the book in a way that I think most people wouldn't expect. I mean, the book is titled Planet X, Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, and you begin with a really detailed study of God's conflict with the primordial chaos dragon, Leviathan, Rahab, known in other ancient Near Eastern cosmologies as Tiamat, or what was it in the Canaanite? Was it Yam?
Yamu.
Mm-hmm. Yamu.
Which
okay.
Means sea.
Right. Okay. Set. Typhon. Any number of. There's a common thread, as you mentioned, in the cosmologies of the ancient Near East, and as you, I think, rightly suggest, drawn from a common source. With the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the account in Genesis being the only accurate one, and then the other accounts sprinkled throughout the Old Testament, Job, Isaiah,
the Psalms.
Psalms, right. So how does Planet X relate to the creation epic? How did this story play out, and how was it remembered and recorded in the Bible?
The creation epic is basically a description of how the earth was created as a result of a conflict between God and a dragon. It's symbolically described in the book, in the Bible throughout. It's Psalm 74, various places in this, all the places in the Psalms, Book of Job, it is all over the place. Psalm 74 is the most obvious description, where it actually says, art thou the one that, crushed the hedge of the Leviathan into the waters. Let me pull this up here. And this sort of thing is kind of lost, but it's clearly shown in the Genesis 1, where the word for but the deep is Tihom, which is the same word used by the Babylonians for the name of the dragon goddess Tiamat. It's the same word. It's just the difference. The only difference is that the word Tiamat has the letters AT at the end, which indicates it's a female personal pronoun. It's a being rather than it isn't Tihom, where it is just a dead piece of matter. It's not alive. It doesn't have a personality. So that's the core difference. That is the key difference between the two traditions. The Hebrew tradition, which does not believe that the earth is a deity, that there's only one deity, it's a monotheist tradition, whereas with the Babylonians, who were related to the Hebrews, they came from a similar background, ethnically. They were both descendants of Shem. The Babylonians took a more idolatrous direction, where the same information was thought of as in terms of the battle between different deities. So you have the different traditions were basically described in two different ways. The oldest book of the Bible, which I think is actually the book of Job, is actually the Hebrew creation epic version. Whereas the information regarding the creation was described as terms of a dialogue between God and man. There's no other God, it's just God and men. And but they describe this battle between God and the dragon. He says, this battle with Leviathan and so forth, and later in Job. It's actually retranslated in my book. A lot of this is actually creation material, very, very similar in scope and description to that described in the Numeralish. It's just expressed in a different way, where there are no the names of deities that I mentioned, but there is a scripture between battle between God and the dragon in numerous cases. Mm-hmm. This is other deities like Lachmu, Lahamu, Anshar, Kishar, which are all Sumerian deities and Babylonian deities, which appear in the Numeralish. And Sitchin believes that they are actually descriptions of Lachmu and Lahamu are actually Mars and Venus. Anshar and Kishar are actually Jupiter and Saturn. Ya and Nudimud are Uranus and Neptune, and so forth. And his description actually matches up pretty well with the actual state of affairs in our solar system. So I think he might have actually been right on that. It's a possibility. The question is, are you able to accept it? I mean, modern astronomers think it's all bonkety. They think that's religious nature, is all old-fashioned and all relevant. And you have hyper-religious people who believe that anything having to do with science is wicked. Science is inherently wicked. So we shouldn't look at it because it's misleading. It's making us believe the Earth is older than 6,000 years.
Right, and you have to read
the heresy, which it isn't.
And if you're reading the Bible, you've got to read it literally so that you're taking ancient Near Eastern cosmology and trying to interpret it through a 21st century scientistic bias.
As you know, it's a very difficult road to hoe. You have to overcome the hyper-religious to believe, the King James Bible is the real and true Word of God, word for word. I mean, even though it's just a translation, I mean, you have other translations where the King James is the only one. You got people like that, and you got scientists that don't believe any of it's true. You have people, like these new age types who are like, they think the Sumerians or Sitchin was right and the Bible was wrong, and I think their Sumerian gods are real.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets a little silly, so you have to be careful. And they all talk about Planet X as if it's owned by them, so. I've been trying to get it away from the Sitchinites and move it into its correct place, because I do believe it is integral to God's plan for the earth and humanity in general, as we said in our original interview years back. God used Planet X to bring mankind in, and he'll use Planet X to take him back out again, like that old show where he mentioned, can't really mention that guy's name anymore, but it's God's parameters for creation. He used it to create the earth, and he'll use it to take it out again.
Yeah.
Everything in between was just a temporary staged event where God, the Earth was set up as a staging point for mankind to be judged, and then at the end it'll take Earth out. Actually, if we take the Bible literally, Earth will actually be destroyed by fire. My theory is that Planet X will come close enough to Earth to actually hurl it into the sun. The world will be destroyed, and everything on it will be destroyed forever.
Well, yeah, as Peter...
Planet X will actually take its place in orbit around the sun. It'll be our new home. This is the new heavens and new earth he's referring to. It's not just a refurbished earth. It's actually a brand new planet.
That's fascinating, because Peter prophesies that all of the elements will burn up with a fervent heat. In other words, everything is going to literally melt.
Yes, and Isaiah said the earth will be clean, dissolved, totally destroyed.
Yeah.
So my theory is that Planet X will actually be the replacement for Earth, a new Earth, not just a refurbished one, but a brand new one.
Wow.
So those who survive, those who accept Christ as their Savior, will be saved from that wrath to come, with the Earth not only being its surface being ravaged, but the entire Earth itself being totally destroyed.
Hmm. I just had this mental image of Yahweh there in his... you know, saying, calling the shot, you know, third planet in the side pocket, you know.
That's a pretty good analogy. It's kind of the divine delayed player, because that's what he's been doing this whole time.
Wow.
You can think of Planet X as this great white throne, which he uses to judge the planets, particularly Earth. Rolling it in, and basically, the Sumerians called it the divine shepherd, the planet which crosses. They call it Nibiru because it's the planet that crosses across the other orbits. The word Nibiru means the planet that crosses, apparently, according to the Sitchin's tradition. I haven't actually checked that, but I don't think he's particularly off on that one. And so God uses this as a kind of a shepherd's crook to manage the solar system, use it to create the Earth. The Earth was actually originally formed in its fourth position, according to the nebular hypothesis. I hold that largely because we can see other planets of formation around other stars. We can see them in the telescopes. Other planets have been seeing information inside of nebula disks, just like it was theorized our planet was formed. So I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think the Earth was created as part of a gradual process and then was specifically modified for use for mankind to live on by God, using Planet X as that great tool to achieve that goal.
Okay, and Planet X, and I want to get into some of the specifics of the creation myths here, the similarities, the parallels between the Babylonian, Sumerian, Akkadian, Ugaritic, and Hebrew accounts. You know, what are some of the parallels, and you know, again, how does that relate to the creation that we're riding around on right now? It's interesting that as we're talking about this, now, do I understand correctly, Planet X, you believe, was originally in where the asteroid belt currently resides, correct? Between Mars and Jupiter.
You mean Earth?
The Earth was first out there?
The Earth was number 4. It wasn't number 3. Earth was formed originally in where the asteroid belt is now, and the asteroid belt is the partial remains of the original Earth.
Okay, and knocked out of position by this Planet X, then it shoved us into a closer orbit around the sun.
Yes, and we actually see this in the book of Genesis, chapter 1. It's actually there in detail. If you have eyes to see it, I'm willing to understand.
Okay.
But I can go into that next situation.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing I think is really fascinating is right now NASA's got a probe around one of the remnants still in the asteroid belt, the planetoid Ceres, and there are some really strange phenomena that they can't explain on Ceres, glowing areas in a crater and then a 4-mile-tall pyramid-shaped mountain that's got glowing streaks down one side. That may be apropos of nothing. I mean, totally irrelevant, but just interesting that while we're discussing this, Dawn is the name of the probe, is orbiting Ceres and trying to figure out what's going on with these glowy spots on this little remnant of whatever space catastrophe took place there in the asteroid belt. But, you know, back to the creation myths. What are the similarities, the parallels between the different accounts, the battle between the primordial dragon and a deity, a creator deity? And how do we see this recorded in the Bible?
Well, the primary place in the Bible is actually Genesis 1 itself, but it has to be retranslated in terms of understanding what they meant here. First of all, the creation of the earth was actually a covenantal act. It was a dividing of stone into two pieces, like we have the Ten Commandments with Abraham splitting of the animal in two pieces, and the flaming pot was passed in between them. That was a reproduction of the events that had led to the foundation of the earth. In the Numerians, you have a similar situation where Marduk shot an arrow into the heart of Tiamat down her throat, splitting her in half. Using one piece were to create heaven, the other piece were to create earth. Her head was actually described as being used to as being moved in a different position and used to create earth. And her body, her tail particularly, was described as being twisted into a circle in heaven called the derma, the rakia. Rakia is, which literally means a twisted circle or a hammered bracelet. Something that's broken out and smashed and formed into a circle in heaven. And we have a similar thing. The Rakia actually is cognate to, or the Rakis, it was called in Akkadian. And the cognate in Hebrew is rakia, which is where we get the word firmament. And this is similar to what you were talking about. The firmament literally means something that is broken into small pieces and stretched out, not hammered into a flat plate, but actually broken into small bits like a rock being shattered. So you have the rakia, or the rakis and Akkadian, both mean something that's broken into small pieces and twisted into a circle, in which rotates in heaven to this day. That is the perfect description of the asteroid belt, and which is something that was broken into small pieces and stretched out.
Yeah.
And also, it says the waters above and the waters below. In the last few years, it's been determined that the asteroid belt contains very large amounts of water, which is they did not expect to find there. It would not be there unless it had been taken from a body which originally held a lot of water. So they're also confused about that, and also related to the comets. The comet Vilf 2 was originally, a few years ago, was probed by the Stardust probe.
Mm-hmm.
When they brought it back, they expected to find material from the comet's tail to be evidence of, you know, what things like in the outer solar system, because that's allegedly where the comets were formed. But when they got that material back, they found that the comet had actually formed in the inner solar system.
Hmm.
My theory was, according to the book, is that both the comets and the asteroids, both been built and otherwise, all originated from Earth's mantle when it was struck by a satellite of Planet X. And all the evidence, scientific and otherwise, points to that conclusion, including the information from the comet, which came from the inner solar system, the water ice on the asteroids. Everything points to the idea that it originated from a water-bearing body, which Earth is a classic example. And even in Enuma Elish, Tiamat was known for her waters. That was what she was all about. She was a watery deity,
mm-hmm.
who symbolized a watery planet. And her children, the 11 roaring dragons, that she used to defend herself against Marduk, who was the Babylonian equivalent of God, those are all filled with water, just like the comets were. And they were described as being, you know, having fearsome halos and that sort of thing. Perfect description of a comet. Comets, the halos are actually made out of water that's been sublimated. The Soviet experience actually did a very good job of describing the comets and how they were formed out of Earth's mantle in an amazingly effective way. And the Bible does so in less of an obvious way, but it does so.
Hmm.
And it's too detailed to get into here. It's deep into Job and things like that with those descriptions of the heavenly ice floating in space and that sort of thing.
Right, yeah. Comets are often described by astronomers as dirty snowballs.
Dirty snowballs, right. And there's very, very similar descriptions of related to the creation of these heavenly, icy, watery bodies floating around in space. Very, very similar.
It's a different way
of portraying the same information. And one of my most interesting conclusions I came to was, besides Job, which I just found amazing, Planet X is clearly the key to unlock Job, there's no question about it, but Genesis I found particularly interesting when I retranslated Genesis, and taking this idea of God taking this primordial stone and cutting earth into two pieces. And it says, Bereshit literally means in the beginning. And it's kind of related to the idea of dividing a stone into two pieces. It's like a jeweler cutting a stone into two pieces, just like we have in Enuma Elish where the Tiamat, the dragon, who symbolized the earth, was also cut into two pieces.
Hmm.
So you have this background, cultural background, we have a very similar approach. What I found particularly interesting was not only the description of Tiamat being cognate to the word Tohu, which means deep sea. The idea of the word Tohu Wabohu, I thought maybe actually that'd be a short form of Tiamat and Behemoth. Because in the epic, Tiamat was considered the earth, and she had a consort named Kingu, whom Titian believed actually symbolized the moon. And we know from science that scientists not believe and have for a while that the moon was actually created from Earth's mantle as a result of a giant impactor.
Right, right.
Striking the Earth and digging out a large amount of the mantle and jetting it into space where it cooled and solidified and formed the moon. And it occurred to me when I say the Earth was tohu wabohu, which could be translated as without form and void.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the context it's more accurate that it says Earth was Tiamat and Behemoth, not Tohu Wabohu, which literally means when you take away the logical aspect, Earth was then divided into Earth and Moon.
Without form and void, also, chaos and the empty, like an empty waste, which, Tiamat was a chaos dragon. And if I remember correctly, wasn't Tiamat's husband or consort Abzu, the Abyss?
Abzu was kind of the all-father kind of, I guess she was kind of the husband, but her consort was actually Kingu.
Kingu, okay.
Chief of the Headley Army. Abzu was like a son. But yeah, that's another aspect of it. The analogy wasn't perfect because they were using human metaphors to describe him.
Sure, right.
The Abzu was considered to be kind of the great deep, the abyss, from which all the heavenly waters flowed forth and out of which the gods formed.
Right.
It's a metaphor for the earth, for the sun, the solar nebula forming as it was when the sun formed. And out of this heavenly waters formed the various planets, as we see happening in different stars in our solar system.
Okay.
So that I thought was accurate, too. The description, I think, was right on there. But it's also another particularly interesting thing about Genesis 1. I think it's 1, 2, what is it here? The idea of the Spirit of God moved above the face of the water.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The script of words here is the hover, the idea is of a bird hovering over its eggs in order to keep it warm. Marokopeth, I think it is. And the idea is that when a bird hovers over its eggs to keep them warm, it not only covers them with its feathers to keep them warm, but also rolls them. Now, it occurred to me that since Earth was moved out of its original position in the fourth position to the third, according to Sitchin's theory, the idea of a mother bird keeping her eggs warm, it would make sense because in order to keep their eggs warm, in order for God to make the Earth warm enough to sustain life, it would have to be rolled into a position closer to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this idea of the Spirit of God, which the basic word here is ruach, which means a wind. The idea of this wind pushing or blowing Earth into a position closer to the sun, where it will be warmer. So you have the idea of rolling and warming in the same concept of this brooding word. God rolled Earth into a position closer to the sun, where it would be warmer and able to sustain life. The concept of the rolling egg and the concept of the warming all kind of baked into this simple concept of the mother hen brooding over the of the chicks.
Hmm.
God uses divine wind, this Holy Spirit, this ruach, which Sitchin described, actually in the New English, the Marduk is described as having 11 great winds, which he used to push push the earth and divide it and move it. So you have the same concept of wind in the Bible, moving earth, rolling into the position close to the sun, where it remains warmer. So the parallel is perfect.
Hmm.
And it would have to be this way, because if earth did form in the fourth position, it would not be close enough to the sun to be warm enough to sustain life. So God actually used this planet satellite to move earth to a position closer to the sun where life could be sustained. Hmm. And so the Spirit of God hovered above the waters should be translated as, and the Spirit of God moved the earth to a position closer to the sun.
Interesting that, and I know that there are people who are going to hear this and their gut reaction is going to be, no, wait a minute, this is just too weird. But I think it's intriguing that the scholars behind the ESV Study Bible, who are not really given to ascribing prophetic significance to things in the Bible that many of us are willing to see as future events. They will often look for naturalistic explanations. For example, in Job, Behemoth and Leviathan are often referred to as, that this was a hippopotamus or a crocodile or a whale. But in Genesis 1-2, the note does discuss that, say, critical scholars argue that the word deep is a remnant of Mesopotamian mythology from the creation account called Enuma Elish. Marduk, in fashioning the universe, had to vanquish Tiamat, a goddess of chaos. These scholars believe that the Hebrew god had to conquer the chaos deity, Tiamat, in the form of the deep. Now, they're ascribing identity of Tiamat to the deep instead of... am I correct in understanding you that you do not That you do not equate the deep, that the Spirit of God is hovering over, with Tiamat or Leviathan.
Is with a deity or with the same deity?
I don't think
it's a deity, no. But it's the same deity, the same thing that the Babylonians deified as a goddess.
Right.
We're talking about the same thing from different perspectives.
Yeah, and
the Babylonians saw it as a living being, a god, whereas the Hebrews correctly saw it as just an object.
Right, right.
Not alive.
But we do see in other places in Scripture, as you point out, and you mentioned Psalm 74, where the ESV, to their credit, do use word like sea monsters, as opposed to the NIV, which tends to really naturalize everything. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the waters. You broke crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You split open springs and brooks, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And again, in Job, there are several places where God's mastery of those of Leviathan and Behemoth is recorded. So this process described actually the process of breaking apart something that was orbiting the old Earth that was orbiting in the space occupied now by the asteroid belt, knocking it into the current orbit, and also busting off a piece and creating the moon. Is that
correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That's correct.
Now,
same event. There was two impacts. The first impact, which was with a rocky satellite of planet X, which struck and divided Earth into two pieces. Much of the debris was left in its orbital path as the asteroid belt. And the other one embedded itself. And when it struck Earth, it embedded itself deeply into its mantle, where it remains to this day. And it shot out a lot of the inner mantle that was currently inside of the Earth, outside of the Earth, into orbit around the Earth, where it cooled and solidified and formed Earth's moon. And then a second satellite struck Earth, one that was more gaseous in nature, probably one it had picked up on its way past the outer planets, which are gas planets. And that had less of a destructive effect. It had more of a pushing effect than a crushing effect. And this had the effect of pushing the Earth closer to the sun, imparting its energy in more of a gentle way, so it was not nearly as destructive. But it's still the effect of moving Earth. And this is what's talked about in Genesis 1:2, the Spirit of God held it over the deep.
Mm.
Really, what's literally meant to say here is the Spirit of one of these heavenly satellites, gaseous satellite, pushed Earth into a position close to the sun, where it was warm and could sustain life.
Mm.
So it was more of a two-tiered thing. One which divided the Earth into two pieces and created the moon, and another which pushed Earth into a position close to the sun. Other characteristics were imparted to the Earth, including giving it a rotation rate, axial tilt, and a number of other features which are unique to Earth, and all of which are required to sustain life.
Hmm. There are those who will listen to this and say, and I think mistake your intent, and maybe I'm slanting the question by phrasing it that way, so forgive me for doing so, but there may be some who hear this or read a summary of the book and interpret your research as indicating a natural explanation for the miraculous events that we record in the Bible, the creation, the sign in the heavens indicating the birth of our Savior and the coming sign of the return of the Savior. How do you respond to that?
Well, God created the universe and everything in it. If he has to create a miracle, I think it's because of the hard-heartedness of the people. And Jesus said as much. Only a wicked generation seeks a sign. If you need a miracle to believe, then that's the problem. The problem is with you, not with God. He created the earth and the heavens, and they all show his glory all the time. Everything that happened is because he wanted it to happen according to his plan. And if you need a miracle, then you need to believe in God, then you need to examine your heart, because that means you are looking after signs rather than letting the Holy Spirit flow within you, lead you into all truth.
Hmm. And I guess what I'm saying here is there's a difference between your book and the explanations that we can see on any given Sunday on the History Channel, where they try to explain away the plagues against the Egyptians as the result of of natural phenomena.
It might be somewhat a natural phenomenon. In fact, the plagues themselves were a natural phenomenon. But they had a divine origin. So
a divine origin.
are miraculous as opposed to simply being purely natural events which had nothing to do with God.
Exactly.
They're trying to get God without God and God's miracles without God in them.
Exactly right. Yeah, God, the Egyptians were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Moses got lucky, in other words, is the naturalistic explanation. The timing of Planet X, you've got, you know, obviously the three key events here: creation, the introduction of Christ into the into our timeline, you know, his arrival and his return. You also mentioned in the book Abraham and the destruction of Mesopotamia. And I've got to confess, and this is embarrassing because I'm not a historian, but I'm kind of a history geek, and I enjoy reading about periods of history that are fascinating. And the ancient Near East is where it all began. So that's fascinating. I didn't realize that Ur of the Chaldeans, which is the Iraqian Ur, my personal belief is that Abraham actually originated further north, that he came from what is now southern Turkey. But be that as it may, the influence of the Sumerian culture extended up that far. I didn't realize that Sumer had been destroyed by a rain of, you know, flaming stones around the time of Abraham. Of course, we all know that, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah were demolished about that time. But was that another pass of Planet X? What can we determine from history about its orbital cycle?
Well, the Sumerians themselves told about this destruction of Ur in their Lamentation texts. The Lamentation over the destruction of Ur and the Lamentation over the destruction of Sumer Ur. There's two different texts. You can find them in Pritchard's book, Ancient Eastern Texts Related to the Old Testament, and probably online too. And basically, they talk about how their god Enlil, kind of the rough equivalent of God, kind of the sky god, who appeared in the sky as a star, and basically an 8-rayed star, very similar to the star of Bethlehem we see even today on Christmas time, the Dingir, the symbol. That portrayed Anu, not Anu, which literally means a star. In the Babylonian mythology, the word for star and the word for god, the symbol was symbol. So Enlil was kind of the Sumer Akkadian version of Anu. And they believe that this star had appeared in the sky around 2000 BC and hurled down a fiery spear down onto Sumer, destroying it, particularly Ur III, the capital. And they describe how this heavenly spear struck in the south, in the marshlands, in the marsh area of modern Iraq, you know, the Persian Gulf, and how it, as a result, there was a massive wind, a fire, and a flooding rain, which is exactly what happened if you had a meteorite strike, a large asteroid strike that area. You'd have a blast wave followed by fire and then rain falling. Because it fell in a marsh area, all that water would be thrown up into the air.
Right.
And then it would come raining down. And during the 1980s, they found, I discovered that there was a large asteroid impact crater in southeastern Iraq in the marsh areas. And they determined that an asteroid had fallen somewhere between 2000 and 3000 BC and it basically destroyed everything around it for miles. And I determined, I have a diagram in my book, that a sizable asteroid would indeed would have fallen if it had fallen in the place they said where the asteroid crater is. I mean, it's no denying it. It's a fact. We can go see it right now if you want to. And there's pictures. Such an asteroid would have been large enough to obliterate everything around it for miles. Caused exactly the events described in the book, the Lamentation books of Sumer and Ur. And also the events described in the book of Job, which were identical as described in those Lamentation texts. You had a wind from the wilderness, you had fire, and you had this, floods. And I don't know if they had floods in the book of Job, I forget, but the wind from the wilderness destroying the houses and killing all the sheep and the cattle. Exact same thing happened to the Sumerians right around 2000 BC because of the result of this fire from heaven. So you have this, and also I found particularly interesting. There was actually, in Enuma Elish, was actually a congregation of the gods in the heavens, not once but twice. And I found that there were two rough alignments of the planets all in one quarter of the heavens. That happened twice, sometime between 2000 and 1900 BC. So what I think was, and also this also occurs, there's two gatherings of the sons of God, which is how, the angels are described in the Bible, and there it's kind of a theological practical saying, it's a way of saying a gathering of the gods or divine beings in the Bible. They're not gods, they are divine beings, so they're called sons of God instead of the gods. And there's also two gatherings of sons of God in the book of Job, which I think parallels the Nemean Lish. What they were describing was a gathering of the planets in one area of the heavens, right around, I think it was 1917 BC, something like that, which is the time marker for the events of the book of Job and also the destruction of Sumer, in my opinion. They put that information in there so that those who understood how stars and how the planets move could turn the clock back and see exactly when this happened by seeing when was the last time that there was two conjunctions or two gatherings of the planets in the heavens on one side of the earth, where you can see them all in the heaven, all in the sky at the same time. And I think the last time this happened was sometime during the early 19th century BC, like 1920, 1930, something like that. So I think both the Book of Job and the Babylonian creation epic in the Malish marked the time of the appearance of Planet X is probably sometime during the 19th century BC.
Yeah, that's
at least the destruction events. The destructive events that happened around that time.
Yeah, 1 Job 1:17 records, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And this messenger says, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So that's the reference there to the fall of something from the skies that caused destruction, destroyed much of Job's wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got that event. We've got, of course, the sign in the sky at the time of Christ's birth, about roughly 2,000 years later, and we're about 2,000 years down the road from the birth of Jesus Christ. A little more than that now. Where is Planet X now?
Well, Planet X, I calculated, actually probably moves around 5,000 miles per hour. I don't know where it is now, but if it was going to come here within the next 10 years, it would probably have to be somewhere approaching the orbit of Jupiter pretty soon in order to come anywhere near us. I think I calculated that that would actually appear, and as soon as it approached past the orbit of Jupiter, because that's where comets start to become visible, because that's when they start to become, they get enough of the solar wind to cause sublimation in their tails, which creates their tails, which is water ice basically being instantly change from ice form to vapor form. And as the process of sublimation occurs, the solar wind is not powerful enough for that to happen until, I think, sometime they get past the orbit of Jupiter on their way back into the solar system. And that's when they become visible. Otherwise, they're almost totally invisible, because most comets are almost nearly or blacker than coal, because they're covered with a thick tar-like organic material, which just makes them blacker than coal. But when the comet tail forms, they become very, very bright, and that's when we can see them. I think Planet X is very similar. It has characteristics similar to that of a comet, except it's much, much bigger. And so in order for it to become visible to the Earth, easily at least, to the naked eye, it would have to be at least as close as the planet Jupiter. And at that point, it would start to bring on its characteristic wing-like tail. Instead of a tail behind it, actually has what looks like wings. That's what it looks like in the Sumerian cosmology. You have this giant winged planet. That's the description of Planet X. It also has a tail, but it has much very large wings, and these wings are gigantic, and they spread many, many over a large portion of the sky when it's in its full flower. When it actually comes, I don't know, but as soon as the tribulation begins, you could expect it to become visible from the Earth within 3 or 4 years.
What is the impact for us on planet Earth? This is a topic that has a lot of people very nervous, very afraid. How should we properly respond to the return of Planet X?
Well, the return of Planet X is basically an attack of God upon the forces of evil on Earth. This is a revival of the battle between God and the dragon, which has occurred prophecy to occur again in the end times. In fact, the description of God's battle with the dragon Leviathan is described in I think it's Isaiah 29, as not happening in ancient times, but happening in the future, in the apocalypse. When we have the end times, this is a revival of the old God versus dragon conflict. So when Planet X returns, as it returns, you could expect the dragon to revive and for it to, you know, increase its power over the earth again, as described in the book of Revelation. We have the dragon rising from the sea, and with the seven heads, just like Leviathan and Lotan and the Canaanite myths. The seven-headed dragon will rise again and take over the earth, the purpose being marshaling earth's forces to fight against the second coming of Christ. So you'll basically have not only a battle of the heavenly army versus the earthly army, you'll have the battle of the heavenly planet versus earth once again. This is another a revival of this ancient conflict between God and the dragon, between Jesus and Satan, which will take place again in the end times, both of whom have control of their respective planets, which they will use to attack each other and battle each other, and they try to gain advantage of each other by trying to use the entire planet and its resources against each other.
Hmm.
So when you're talking about how, what do you do, it's like, what do you do in the apocalypse? You dig in deep and you hope for the best. This is going to be a big deal. I mean, we're going to have asteroids flattening entire countries, entire cities, or islands. The entire Earth's crust is going to be displaced. Islands, all the hills and the islands moved in their places. Someone actually asked me this, through email, what does that mean? And I said, because it says in Revelation, I think it's a sixth seal, when all men try to dig in and tell the earth of rocks and the mountains, hide us in the face of the one on the throne and the wrath of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. That is when the planet X first appears and becomes visible to the earth, because they're seeing this is God's throne. He's coming towards us. He's going to destroy us. And the only way to escape this possibly is to dig in deep and hope for the best. And right after that, you have the seventh trumpet sound, or the seventh seal open, and then you have these, what are sounded like asteroids and comets striking the earth. You have this, fiery mountain striking the earth. You have all kinds of stuff, causing all kinds of problems. Stars falling from the earth. And what you have is like what you had in, 2000 BC. You have asteroids striking major cities and destroying them, like where the Chaldees, like Sodom and Gomorrah. All these cities are going to be destroyed again, because this is they are part of the forces of the dragon, who are enemies of God, and therefore God is sending asteroids down to destroy them, just like he did 4,000 years ago.
Hmm.
There's nothing new here. This is an ongoing battle. I suspect this has happened previously in Earth's history. It could be the world before the flood was a similar situation, where the flood was actually preceded not only by asteroids taking out large populations of giants all at once, but you have followed by a flood, maybe a comet possibly dumps huge amounts of water over the earth and causes flooding. Could be asteroids struck, one or more asteroids struck the oceans and sent up huge amounts of water, which, and tidal waves, which flooded the earth and rained over everything, covered everything with rain. With that which wasn't destroyed by tidal waves was flooded with rain. This is how God operates. He sends these asteroids into obliterate his enemies. That's a repeated thing. Even in the book of Joshua, most of God's enemies, the enemies of Israel, were destroyed by stones that fell from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's a repeating pattern. It's very predictable, easily seen just by reading the scriptures. Nothing new here. There's nothing new under the sun.
And since it was prophesied, and we see, we by reading the end of the book of Revelation, we know that, the forces of God win, he is successful, will be successful in executing his final judgment on his enemies, Satan, death, cast into the lake of fire. Where do we see Planet X in the book of Revelation?
Planet X is actually alluded to in chapters 2 and 3. When Jesus says, "I am the bright morning star," he's actually referring to Planet X and its appearance. There's also, he says, "I will take you over to my throne." I think what he's actually referring to is his throne, and the planets are actually part of the thrones of God. He's actually referring to Planet X. And I don't think it's actually his throne per se, but I think it's more of a throne chariot that he rides into battle. When he goes to battle against the forces of evil. Like I alleged earlier, Satan has his planet, which is planet Earth. God has his planet, which is planet X, and he uses it to judge the Earth occasionally. This is going to be one of those times when this happens.
Mm.
The most prominent description of planet X in Book of Revelation is actually the throne, description of the throne in Revelation 4, I believe. Yes.
The throne in heaven, right.
The throne in heaven, Revelation 4. I said, I thought about this, and I was in the context of my studies of Planet X and M.A. Lish and other ancient Near Eastern concepts of, God and the heavenly throne and so forth. And I realized that, this sounds remarkably like the description of Marduk in his enthronement in Babylon and creation. I began to realize, this is the throne of God, and this throne of God is Planet X. This is what it is. Because, and I'll tell you why here. In the Nome Elish, there was seven groups. There was 11 total winds around Marduk, a group of seven and a group of four. In Revelation 4, it says here, there are four beasts with six wings.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there is another group here. I think it's another seven here.
Seven torches of fire where the seven spirits of God are, where the seven.
And four beasts.
Right.
Another group of four and another group of seven.
Right.
Now, the metaphor and the description is different. They're called beasts and torches of fire, whereas in the Elish, they were described as winds, which kind of rotate around Marduk and protected him.
Hmm.
And also, you have this great flood storm, you talk about the Ancient of Days, which has this great white flowing beard, which is the same thing as this. This is the Daniel's version of Revelation 4. The word for comet actually means long white hair. So I think what they have in the Ancient of Days is actually not a description of God's white flowing hair. It's actually a description of Planet X's huge comet-like tail and wings. So we have here, this is the description of the theophany, which is the appearance of Planet X. He says, behold, was thrown a throne set in heaven. Literally, there is a planet in heaven which looks like this. And it says it's like a sardius stone, which is a red stone.
Mm-hmm.
Planet X is described by the Sumerians as being red in appearance as it first appears. It's surrounded by satellites. You have these group of four satellites, group of seven satellites, maybe another 24 satellites, which aren't described in the New English, which describes the thrones of the elders. And in fact, the word for throne in Hebrew, which is kiseh, literally means something as large and white and, set in heaven. In fact, one of the words for moon is based on the word kiseh. So the idea, the ancient Near Eastern concept of a throne was something that was large and round and white, or large and round. Not a typical throne chair like we think now. It was something that was round.
Hmm.
So you have this large, red, round object surrounded by satellites in heaven. Right after a description in Revelation 3, Jesus is talking about, I am the bright morning star. Then he goes into the description. Here it is. To him that overcomes, I will sit with me on my throne, even as I also overcame. And I am sat down with my Father in his throne. And the last verse of the previous of chapter 2 was, and he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him I will give power over the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father, and I'll give him the morning star.
Give him the morning star, yeah.
So the last verse of chapter 2 was morning star. Still with me on that morning star. Last verse of chapter 3, the last verses is, I will grant you to sit on my throne. So we have a throne that is a star, conceptually. And then he talks about the starry throne, this image of the throne in heaven, surrounded by satellites, has a huge comet-like tail. Everything else is described in the Elish is like Marduk, inappropriately attributed to Marduk. This is Jesus' throne, okay? And he's describing in detail Planet X in chapter 4, in my opinion.
And this is not a new stylistic tactic in the Bible. We see elsewhere, Isaiah in particular, who takes descriptive language used of other ancient Near Eastern deities, specifically Baal in Isaiah's case, and applies it to Yahweh. And here we've got something similar, apparently, where Jesus is, am I understanding that correctly? Jesus using similar language to say, no, that this is not Marduk, this is me.
Right. He's saying, these other deities, they are not God. I am God.
Right.
I have inherited this throne. This is mine. None of the other deities who were falsely given control, Baal, Ashur, all the other ones from over thousands of years. Jesus has inherited this throne. He is in control of this planet. He's going to rule over it. And this is going to be the replacement planet for Earth. And those who take him his forgiveness will be allowed to live in this planet forever. Whereas those who take on the mark of the beast will be destroyed along with the beast, and everything he built and everything he did will, after the 1,000 years are over, be thrown into the sun.
Hmm.
And, right? And the new planet will be this new planet, which we're currently calling Planet X, the actual name of which we don't know yet.
Hmm. Fascinating stuff. There's a lot more in the book, which is, again, heavily researched and footnoted. Lots of diagrams and illustrations, which really help. A lot of images from the ancient Near Eastern text and their sculptures and ceiling stones, ceiling cylinders, things like that, that help to illustrate your point. And, you know, it's kind of fun being able to go in every day and see the books there. I'd like to see some of these move out of the warehouse and into folks' hands, because it is a different perspective. And you know, maybe I'm just an optimist, but actually I take away, you know, a sense of optimism from all of this. It's like, yeah, okay, there is destruction coming, but hey, it's because God's in control, and this is all ultimately going to work for the good of those who love him. And so there is no need to fear when we start looking at and thinking about subjects like Planet X. Doug, the book, where would you recommend people go if they would like to get a copy of Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age?
Well, it's being promoted by SurvivalMall.com. So is it SurvivalMall.com?
Well, it's now SkywatchTVStore.com.
Just go to SkywatchTVStore.com and buy it there. You can also pick it up on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and so forth, but Skywatch is probably the best place to go. And it'll help Tom and Derek with their ministry. You know, do more fun stuff, more fringy ideas like Planet X and Giants and all kinds of fun stuff, which you'll never find in your mainstream stores or your mainstream pew, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it's one of the interesting things is as we moved to the area here and had discussions with Tom about partnering with him in what is now Skywatch TV, his vision was actually to move away from what he calls Nephilimery to discuss other issues, because there are other things out there. Yes, that's important to understand, so that you get a real sense of the spiritual war, the supernatural war that's been taking place since the beginning of time. Your book, Doug, I think is another aspect of that, and just thinking about the scope, the scale of the warfare that has taken place as part of this long-running war, and the warfare and the battles that are yet to come, is just awe-inspiring. Make a heck of a movie if anyone ever was so inclined to come up with something like this. But
I'd love to do a movie on this subject. Actually, my undergrad was actually in film production.
If you guys
ever want to get involved in a movie, I'm interested.
I will put a bug in Mr. Horn's ear, because this would be a fascinating topic for a future documentary production. It would be nice to see this topic addressed from a biblical and scholarly perspective instead of I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens perspective of the History Channel.
I'll go by air extra long and spiky.
There you go. Doug Elwell is the author of Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age. Planet X at the Creation, Nativity, and Second Coming. Doug, fascinating as always, and we'll have to talk again.
All right, thanks, Derek.
There's a link in the show notes that will take you to a place you can buy a copy of Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age. Planet X at the Creation, Nativity, and Second Coming. Doug Elwell's book. A lot of stuff in here. I went out and bought a couple of highlighters at the Dollar General so I could go back through and start marking this thing up. Seriously. this and other books that I've got on my shelf so I can find what I'm looking for. Reference material. This goes in the reference shelf or on the reference shelf next to the books that I refer back to from time to time. The takeaway from this, even if you disagree with this theory about Planet X being the means by which Yahweh implements his plan on planet Earth, the takeaway for me is that, if nothing else, and he's right that it's coming back and coming soon, that it is part of God's plan. And therefore, nothing to fear. Now, need to do more reading in here. And again, with the highlighters now, I'm properly equipped to mark it up and go back and dig through it. And we may talk about this again, because again, there's just a lot of meat in this book, far more than we could do justice to in the span of an hour. We've had a busy and very interesting week at the Skywatch TV offices over the past week. A couple of guests that have some really interesting things to discuss, and those will be brought here onto a View from the Bunker over the next week or so. Coming up on Wednesday, our next program, you'll hear from Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. He is a Pentagon strategist, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, who also serves as a military analyst for Fox News, comments on foreign affairs, military preparedness, military cooperation with our allies, and Middle East security. And he's considered an expert on Middle East security on most of the television and cable news networks. He's got a new book called Never Submit, which is a reference to Islam, which, of course, means submission. So his point is kind of telegraphed by the title of the book. And it's very timely given what's been happening in the Middle East over the past year or so. The Islamic State declared the caliphate in June of 2014, and since then they have cut a bloody swath across Iraq, Syria, and other nations in the Middle East. Libya, in fact, is now fighting for its life. What's left of it? Libya really is a failed state at this point. And that is a result of the foreign policy of our current administration. The former Secretary of State very famously said, "We came, we saw, he died." Yes, and so did a lot of other people, including Christians beheaded on the shore of the Mediterranean, our ambassador in Benghazi, and other people. This is sadly a pattern that's been repeated several times now during this administration, and always with poor result. Yemen, Libya, and now Syria, just look at the result. Is this really what we wanted? Well, we can point fingers at how it was created, but the situation is dire. And I think the bigger question is, what do we do now? Where do we go from here? Do we abandon the Christians in the Middle East to their fate, which at this point, without intervention, is extermination? That's the topic of conversation with Colonel Bob McGinnis. And you'll hear that Wednesday evening. I'll post that for September 2nd here on A View from the Bunker. Then Pastor Carl Gallups, best-selling author of The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. His new book is called Be Thou Prepared. And preparedness, for some reason, I shouldn't say for some reason, because I was one of these guys who thought that preparedness was really unbecoming for a Christian. And then I got to meet fellows like Ray Gano and Tom Horn, who made it very clear, and Carl Gallups believes the same, that the reason to prepare is not so that you can hole up in a bunker and let the rest of the world go to hell, but so that you've got enough extra to share with your neighbors, to be a blessing to them in a time of crisis. We'll talk about that. I'm talking future tense. I did talk with him about that. You will hear that conversation 1 week from today, God willing, September 7th. Carl Gallup's new book, Be Thou Prepared. L.A. Marzulli has a new book out called Days of Chaos. I'll talk with him this week, and that will be posted on the 9th of September, Wednesday the 9th. And assuming we can schedule the time between now and then, because I know his schedule is really overloaded, Dr. Michael Heiser has a new book out called The Unseen Realm, and he is going to begin doing interviews beginning this week. And hopefully we'll be able to get some time with him on the phone or via Skype. And so sometime in mid-September, we hope. Failing that, right now the plans are in the works to bring Mike to the Ozarks. And we will have a chance to see him face-to-face and get him onto Skywatch TV. So that is our evil plan at this point. But hopefully, if we get him soon, one of our soon upcoming programs here on A View from the Bunker will be about Mike's book, The Unseen Realm, which has been in the works for quite some time. And another reason I went out and bought those markers, those highlighters at the dollar store. So our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, we closed the book on Numbers today and began on the book of Deuteronomy. So we've got another I guess, milestone as we proceed through Scripture. And today's discussion was really interesting. Numbers chapter 35 deals with something called the cities of refuge, sanctuary cities, and the Avenger of Blood. And on a surface reading, it looks like an interesting cultural phenomenon, sociological phenomenon, a way to keep the peace in the late Bronze Age, rather than blood feuds developing between different clans and destroying a society. There was a designated executioner, basically, for a family who was to avenge the death of someone in the family. But in order to plead his case, the one who caused a death, because sometimes things happen accidentally, sanctuary cities were decreed among the ancient Israelites, where someone who had killed some, taken another life, could run and be protected until his case could be heard. So fascinating stuff, and especially when you look at that and then look at the role that Jesus Christ plays for us Christians. Not only is he our kinsman redeemer, the one who has redeemed us from our bondage, our slavery, but he will come again as the Avenger of Blood. Deep stuff. Sharon did some really good study on this, and that was posted today, Sunday, at gilberthouse.org, where we post all of our Gilbert House Fellowship study sessions, 42 of them now, in fact, now online, including the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Job, and a couple of the Psalms, because we're going through this in chronological order, and some of the Psalms were written during the time of Moses. So fascinating stuff. We post these by mid-late morning every Sunday at gilberthouse.org. Skywatch TV coming up Tuesday night, our interview with Josh Tolley. We begin a series of programs for National Preparedness Month. You heard the View from the Bunker interview with Josh about his book, Evangelpreneur. That will be our discussion, 30-minute discussion for Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 Central, on the Christian Television Network, which is DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, and the Glory Star Satellite Channel 117, and follows our good friends at Prophecy Watchers, Gary Stearman and Bob Ulrich, on the Christian Television Network. If you don't have satellite TV, you can also watch it on the Christian Television Network. Their website is ctnonline.com. That's ctnonline.com, and they have a live stream of their programming, so you can catch it then. And if you miss it, you can catch it later in the week, either on the official Skywatch TV YouTube channel or the Skywatch TV Roku channel. If you have a Roku box, Skywatch TV does have a Roku channel, and you can find it in the channel store. Or there's a link at Skywatch TV on how to add that to your account. View from the Bunker is available at iTunes through Stitcher or a number of other podcatchers out there, and we appreciate your likes and your reviews. By the way, you may have noticed, just very quickly, one final note, that I've closed comments on A View from the Bunker, the website. It's not because I don't like discussion. It's because in a couple of cases recently, there were some nastiness that was brought in from outside, not by our guests, not by regular commenters on the website. And I apologize to those of you who liked leaving comments on the site and did so thoughtfully, even those with whom I disagreed quite frequently, but were very thoughtful and courteous, cordial in their approach. I apologize for that, but there were a couple cases particularly where things got really ugly. Guys who had a problem with a guest and wanted to bring it into the website and drag me into a fight that I didn't have the time, energy, or inclination to either referee or become a part of. The way I view it, and you know, a couple of the fellows who, you know, got kind of upset, sent me private emails, very angry that I had closed the comments. And my view on it is this: this is my house. My website is like my house, and under my roof, my rules apply. You are not guaranteed a constitutional right to engage in libel against, or, you know, make borderline libelous statements about someone else who's in my house under my roof. If you did that in my living room with another guest whom I had invited into my home, I would ask you to leave. And essentially that's what I've done. So the guests are still invited in, but I'm going to limit the visits in the house, the website, to the guests at this point. Now, if you'd like to comment on the programs, look up the View from the Bunker Facebook page. More than happy to post and comment there. But If comments get nasty, I will delete them. Again, I view it as my house, and I don't have to tolerate certain behavior inside my house. So, A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.